Okay, this is Bob Dobbs, and it is October 8th for me in Hawaii, 2019, and I'm speaking to Grace Eckley, and for her it's 7:45 in the morning in Des Moines, Iowa. Hello, Grace.
Hello, Bob.
Okay, I have the privilege of finding out about Grace about 20 years ago and reading her first book on the STED, W.T. STED theme. Now, I just want to bring up a list of your books. I could not find that book earlier this year that I thought I had read. I didn't know, couldn't remember what the title was. But then I found there was a new book that came out in 2018 called The Encryption of Finnegan's Wake. Resolved! Subtitled W.T. STED. And okay. So I just Googled you now, and under Thrift Books it has pictures of all your books, and it says The Steadfast Finnegan's Wake, a textbook. Is that what I would have read 20 years ago?
That probably was it. That was an early one, yes.
Yeah, so do you remember the date when that was published?
Hmm.
Well, according to this review, I think it's 1994. I'll look up the review I have here in the James Joyce Quarterly. Yeah, The Steadfast Finnegan's Wake.
Right.
A textbook, 1994. So, okay, it was published in 1994. And my James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake reading group friend, Murray Gross, lent me the book sometime in the late 90s. And I was quite amazed by it that presumption that the Finnegan's Wake was about somebody. How could that be? You know?
Yes, there was what was called the Joyce industry, you know?
Yes.
And people were turning out all kinds of books, but a lot of them didn't make any sense.
Well, that's right. But when you're dealing with the Wake, you're not allowed to impose authoritatively any particular sense. So there was a free-for-all to say whatever you wanted to say. And then you had the gall to say, no, this is what it's about. Yes, go ahead. Sorry. What did you say?
They had no idea that there would be a person at the basis of Finnegan's Wake.
Nobody had that idea.
No.
Maybe they thought it was James Joyce was at the ground floor, right? They might say James Joyce is about him. So anyways, what happened is I then discovered happily a few months ago your updated book, which is The Steadfast Finnegan's Wake, a textbook, but with all kinds of new information because of all the stuff that came out since it was published in 94, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's called The Encryption of Finnegan's Wake, Resolved, subtitled W.T. STED, published by Hamilton Books in 2018. Okay.
Yes,
so I really enjoyed it, so I said, I got to talk to Grace. So I got in touch with you, but I know nothing about you other than I do remember, I've been reading Finnegan's Wake and looking at it since the 60s. So I remember looking at your book, Children's Lore in Finnegan's Wake, way back in the 70s or 80s, whenever the book came out. So I was aware you did that. So my first question would be, how did you get into literary studies, and then how did you get attracted to Joyce, James Joyce?
Well, I was making a living as a teacher, and mainly I taught Joyce's Ulysses, but I started doing research on Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Okay, so that means you're beginning with you were a professor.
Yes.
Where did you go to school, and what did you do in your undergraduate years? What were you interested in? Were you studying English?
Yes, I got a PhD from Kent State University, and the person who was the advisor of my dissertation there was one of the leading Joyce scholars.
What was his name or her name?
Benstock, B-E-N-S-T-O-C-K, Benstock.
Yeah, the male or his wife?
The male.
Yes. What was his name, first name?
Benstock, B-E-N-S-T-O-C-K.
Wasn't that his last name, Benstock?
Yes.
Yeah, so what was his first name?
Oh, gee.
Okay, doesn't matter. Anyways, he was a well-known scholar, and his wife was a Joycean too, right?
That's an interesting history, and it's rather complicated.
Okay. But we'd like to hear any gossip you have that you feel free to say. We got time. This doesn't have to be
anything I can remember, in other words.
Yes. I remember she was a blonde lady, a pretty blonde lady. I saw pictures of her at Joyce conferences, correct?
Yes, she was. Yes, she did attend Joyce conferences, and so you would have seen her. Yes, she was very attractive.
So was she a student of Ben Stock?
Actually, I went to a conference with her because she was teaching at Drake the same as I was.
Oh.
And when we were at that conference, she got acquainted with Ben Stock, and that's what started their romance.
Right. Now, what year would that be?
Oh, boy.
70s? 60s? When did you start?
It would have been in the 70s, I think.
Okay, so when you were doing undergrad, let's go back to your history. You were doing undergraduate work, and you were doing major and a minor back in those days. That's the way they organized it. So you would do major in English studies? Is that what you were doing?
Yes, basically. I developed another course which proved to be the best one I had, and my husband suggested it because he saw the drift of my interest, and he said I should teach a course called Mythological Backgrounds of Literature, and that became my most popular course.
But see, you're explaining being a teacher. I'm talking about when you're a student, an undergraduate, who doesn't know where you're going to end up. What were you studying as an undergraduate?
I was at Mount Union College in Ohio.
Yes.
Majoring in English.
All right. So when you major in English, are you doing James Joyce your first year, or does it take a couple years to get to that level?
It takes a couple years to get to that level. I starved my way through Mount Union College and had some pretty bad experiences getting through.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have time for anything else except to try to keep body and soul together and get the courses accomplished.
So you did all kinds of different subjects. When did you realize you wanted to specialize in Irish literature or James Joyce or Edna O'Brien? When does that happen, in your third or fourth year, your senior year?
That comes in graduate school.
Oh, okay. So did you know what you were going to do in graduate school on the first day?
No, I was split in two areas. I was teaching Joyce's Ulysses, but I was preparing all of my scholarship in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Wow! Now, this would be in the mid 70s, early 70s. Have you got a date for that?
Yeah.
Where was it?
Where was what?
When you were doing graduate work and teaching Ulysses, what university?
That was at Kent State in Ohio, where I got the degree then.
Okay, so are you there after the shooting, during the shooting?
Oh, that was a terrible experience. I had gone to a Joyce conference with some of the other professors, and when we came back in town, the shooting had already occurred.
Wow.
And we had a Catholic priest in our midst who was a Joyce scholar, and we were not allowed back in town.
Mm.
And so because the police had closed off everything.
Yes.
And so we had to get temporary shelter for the night and that sort of thing and wait until we could get home.
And then you got home within a couple of days.
Yes. But
right.
That experience was quite interesting because one of the persons who stayed there, who was in our group, had experienced the ghost of one of the students who was killed. And
really?
So that was my first acquaintance with ghosts.
Wow, so your friend reported that they saw a ghost of one of the students.
that was, let's see, I have to think a minute, which person was that? That was, yeah, I then when I started teaching again, she told me that she had had that experience, and she said she would never go back to Kent State University again because of that experience with the ghosts.
Right, right. Okay, so I think the shooting was around May 4th, 1970, so it's the first week of 1970. Had you been to a Joyce conference before that one in May 70?
Oh, I had been to several Joyce conferences before that because there was quite an interest in James Joyce, and the conferences were regular in various places.
Yeah, I remember in my mind, in 67 was the first James Joyce symposium or something. Does that sound right?
That sounds good.
Yeah. Did you go to the first one?
I doubt it would have been the first one, but that's when it got the name the Joyce Industry.
Right. Right. So but you went to one of them before Kent State, like 68 or 69?
Oh, yes, certainly.
And would that have been organized by Fritz Sen, someone like that?
I saw Fritz Sen at a great many different conferences, yes, so he would have been one of the organizers.
Right. Okay, so you're just graduating, you're going to go into graduate school, you're already into Joyce, and you're going to conferences, and you've decided to specialize in Finnegan's Wake in this graduate period, right?
Yes, that's where the mystery was. That's what drew me with curiosity.
Yes.
About what was happening with Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, I remember, I know the Joyce world I know through Marsha McLuhan. You know, knowing him, and he was a teacher in the 40s at the University of Toronto, starting in 1946. And I know the copy of Ulysses was locked away. Students had to have permission to look at it. Now,
really? I never heard that before.
Yeah. That was very conservative in Toronto. And so Marshall was reading, of course, Ulysses, but he also was reading Finney's Wake from the day it came out, 1939. And so he starts to write about Finney's Wake. He puts out some major essays in 53, two essays. Now, he's writing about Finnegan's Wake from a media angle, and that's pretty radical and revolutionary.
Yes.
But he's writing about a book that nobody, with any right mind, would enter or teach it. They didn't know what to make of it. So by the late 60s, though, because of the sort of chaos of the 60s, the atmosphere, people were getting more interested in tolerating the image of chaos in Finney's Wake, so they would dare to look at it. Remember that? You remember feeling that way?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, McLuhan helped popularize Finney's Wake in 68 when one of his books had all kinds of quotes from Finney's Wake, which was pretty amazing. Oh, here's this guy using these incomprehensible quotes and actually claiming they make sense to his thesis. Were you aware of Marsha McLuhan in 67, 68 and those books that used the Wake?
No, I was not aware of him at all.
Okay, so that you would then go through the traditional entrance to Finney's Wake through Joseph Campbell? So that would be your beginning?
It was not Joseph Campbell, but he was important toward the end of it. You want to know what was the beginning of my interest in Finnegan's Wake?
Yes, and which were the first books you were looking at?
Yeah, it was just because it existed, I think. It's the old exclamation, because it's there.
Right. But what is the, are you reading the books at the Wake, those early Joyce scholarship books in the 50s and 60s? I forget who did the books at the Wake, but there was another guy who kind of explained, you know, page by page, Finnegan's Wake. There were several of these books, not many.
Yes, that's why it was called the Joyce Industry. There were quite a few.
All right.
People were writing really silly things that made no sense at all.
Okay, give me an example of a silly thing, silly idea?
One person linked it with food, that it encouraged you to eat a certain kind of food, for example.
Somebody wrote a book on that?
Just about anything. Just about anything, yes.
Wow. That's incredible. Was that someone who goes on to do better scholarship, or was just a one-night fling and they didn't do anything more?
There were a great many books produced in the Joyce industry which were never seen again.
Okay, do you remember, were you aware of John Cage at that point, the composer?
No.
Oh, okay. So who
is his name? Is that C-A-G-E?
Yes. Have you ever heard of him?
No, I don't know that. No, I don't know that.
Okay, he became a famous Joycean in the 70s and 80s because he would make acrostic poems quoting from Finnings Wake, and then he did a big opera called Roratorio, a musical, a noise version of Finnings Wake. He did a lot of stuff, but he was quite amazing in avant-garde musical history in the United States. So he drew a lot of attention to Joyce and Finnings Wake. But he was a student of Marshall McLuhan and Bucky Fuller, so he was influenced by them. Okay, so what book, because you're going to do children's lore in Finnings Wake, is that done in the 70s or 80s?
Yes, and it really surprised me because I did not think that it was that great, but it was a book that had the greatest success. It
really?
It was the one that introduced W.T. Stead, of course. And most people had not heard of Stead until they saw that book.
Okay, and do you remember the year you published it?
Let me see. I should have it here somewhere. Should have it on the shelf here.
In the 70s or 80s, right? I'm just wondering if it was in the 70s.
The shelf is too... The things on the shelf are too tight.
Yeah, that's, it's okay.
Narrator and character in Finnegan's Wake was one that I co-wrote with Michael Begnell.
Right.
And that one is, let me see, from Bucknell University Press, 1975.
Okay, narrator and character in Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
Right. What was the response to that book? Positive response? Scholars appreciated?
Yes, that one was very much appreciated.
Yeah, because that's 1975, you said, I think. That's when the French postmodernists, I think it was in 75, they had a conference in Paris, and it was kind of hijacked by Derrida and the Joyce scholars. They locked Hugh Kenner and a bunch of people in a room and forced them to listen to Derrida. Are you aware of those stories?
Yes, I've heard that, but I was not there to. I opposed Derrida, so I didn't go to listen to anything about him.
Yeah, so you didn't. Yeah, you didn't go to the Paris conference of the James Joyce symposium. Okay, so. So you're a graduate teacher in the early 70s, and you're going to Joyce conferences, and narrator and character is going to be your first book. Are you working on children's lore right away for your second book?
Let me see. I have children's lore here somewhere. Here it is. That was much more popular than narrator and character, of course. Children's lore is...
It's a family topic. All the family can read it.
1985.
Oh, okay.
Children's lore in Finnegan's Wake.
All right. So that's your second book 10 years later after narrator and character, correct?
Possibly.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned Stead in the 1985 book. You don't know of him in 75 when you're doing narrator and character.
I don't think so, no.
So how did you find out about him?
Let me see. How did I find out about STED? I know what it was. I was at the time I was trying to find something to do intellectually, and I went to the Drake Library to see if they had anything to suggest that I could work on, and one of the librarians had the book by Joseph Balin, which was a biography of STED, and she handed me a couple sources, and I went home, and I tell you, it happened this fast. That night, I said to my husband, I have found the biographical original of Joyce's Hero.
Wow.
Lincoln's Wake. Yeah, it was that fast.
And you got that within a... Did you read the whole book that night or just the first couple of chapters?
No, I had been reading a great deal in... Oh, are you ready for this? The Thousand Nights and a Night.
Yeah.
Sir Richard F. Burton's.
Yes. The Arabian
volumes.
Nights.
I had purchased all of those.
Wow.
And I had been reading in those. And at the end of the last volume, there is an essay about W.T. STED, and Sir Richard F. Burton just absolutely hated him. And the problem was that STED was interested in prostitution and fighting the causes for it and that sort of thing. And STED forgot where
Burton,
I was going.
Why was Burton mad at him?
Oh, because the STED stuff came out at the same time that Burton wanted to make a great big hit with his with his books, which were the Nights and the Supplemental Nights.
Yes.
And he didn't want to divide attention with this person who nobody knew anything about.
So Burton put out his book in the mid-80s, 1880s, and STED did his thing in 1885. So around the same year when Burton, like I could just Google Burton, and let's see if they give the actual, is it Richard Burton?
Yes.
Yeah, Burton, Arabian Nights.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, so what do they say? When was it? 1885. Amazing. It's the same year.
Yes, that's right. And that's why STED and Burton were in competition.
Wow.
Because STED was saying these other things were going on in the world.
So here it is, Arabian Nights, because of, I mean, did he know in the first edition that he has to write an essay putting down STED? That's put into the first?
He knew. The timing was really original, interesting, because they were simultaneous. And so Sir Richard F. Burton, the great Sir Richard F. Burton, regarded STED as a competitor.
Right,
and
but he would have put his book out, or did STED do his report in his newspaper, I think it was in July, is that before Burton's book comes out, like maybe in the fall of 85?
It was almost simultaneous that what happened with it was that the last volume of Burton's book had an essay in the back of it scolding this person, really angry with this person named W.T. STED. So that was the way that I found STED.
Well, that was before the librarian gave you the book?
Which book are we talking about?
Yeah, the librarian gave you a book on STED. You took it home and read the biography, I guess, of whoever, whatever that book was, and that night
would have
you
been before, yes.
Right, and then because you knew that, then you find Burton, and then you see he does this essay, which must have been posted after 1885. I can't see him putting it in the first edition, but maybe he did. I don't know. But the thing is, he would put out his first edition and see that it didn't get the coverage because Stead was taking up too much of the press. So then he'd put out another edition and write an essay complaining, right? I can't see him writing.
Oh, no, it was all one edition.
Wow.
Burton did only the one in which he wrote an essay, he published an essay in the back of a book about this person named W.T. Stead. And that was the first I had heard of Stead. And he was opposed to Stead because of the competition with the publicity.
Yes, I understand that. But you had already heard of Stead from the librarian.
Oh, I see what you mean. No, we have to go back in time. That was before I went to look for the...
Right, that's why you went to look for him.
Yeah,
so Burton got you looking for him, and this woman, she didn't know much about Stead, but she found the book for you, found a biography, gave it to you, you go home and read it, and you have this eureka, this epiphany, that after a couple hours of reading it.
Yes.
Wow.
I could see it immediately and said to my husband I had found the biographical original of Joyce's hero in Finnegan's Wake.
Well, yeah, biographical original is the technical term, right?
It's the, I don't know, it's just a plain term. That's what it means.
Okay. So do you know the date when that happened? Do you remember it?
No, I don't. I have thousands of publications, I think, and so I don't keep those in my head. In fact, I don't even have a list of them, and I realize now I should have kept a list of my publications. So what was your question?
Okay, so you when you discovered the book, is it after Children's Lore has been published or before?
That's... Children's Lore and Finnegan's Wake.
Is 1985?
That's the Children's Lore I published before. I'm getting confused.
Yeah, narrator is 75 or so, 74, 75. Then 10 years later, you do Children's Lore, and you mentioned Stead in Children's Lore. I think you said that.
Yes.
Right, so that means you already discovered Stead. Sometime between 75 and 85.
Hmm.
Right? Yeah. I mean, you mentioned it in
yeah,
the 85 book.
And I remember it was odd that when I sent the manuscript off, I didn't really have a good opinion of it. And I was astonished that the book was so important to so many people. But that was, for many people, the origin of their awareness of W.T. Stead.
Right, right. Let's see. So then your next book, the Steadfast Finnegan's Wake, a textbook, that comes out almost 10 years later in 94. So that's what you worked on after Children's Lore in 85. Right?
Yes.
You're now focusing on Stead. Are you talking about it at Joyce conferences in the 80s and early 90s before the Steadfast textbook came out?
I remember being at one conference where I presented some information about it, but nobody was paying any attention to it. In fact, I met Ben Stock. I saw him in the hallway at that conference, and he was not interested in following that through at that time.
Well, you told him what you're doing, and he was polite, but he said, "No, I'm not interested." That was that.
That was about it. Yes.
Yeah, his first name's Bernard. Bernard Ben Stock.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so. I've now got the James Joyce Quarterly. It's the, I've got a lot of them, volume 32, number 2, winter 95, and it has this review on page 441.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was really astonishing. I had, I had written a book on Benedict Kiley, who was a popular author in Ireland, and I was often in Ireland because I researched him and wrote the book, and I was often with his friends, and I didn't even know this person was anything special, and she evidently took an instant dislike to me, and she published that terrible article and said I was off my rocker, basically. She was an astonishing person herself. She had 6 children by 6 different men.
Wow.
And so you can tell she was a bit odd herself. And so I was not prepared to have that sort of thing published. And when I went to a conference after that, I realized that she had published that book because the James Joyce Quarterly reviewed her book. Can you imagine? It was something that was... It was a book that wasn't filled with anything that was valuable to scholarship, but they actually reviewed her book. And I tried, even just within the last couple years, to get them to take that off their list of publications, and they refused to. And then the next stage was I went back about my writing the other books and the other things, the other research I was doing, and I came back to that source again and found out that the book was no longer available because they had brought it out in a different edition and nobody knew what it was. So I let it go at that.
Right. You couldn't get her book, you're saying.
I couldn't stop the publication of that article by the James Joyce Quarterly. That's where she told about how I was basically crazy. You know?
Right.
It was pretty awful.
Right. You do your work, you put it out there, and you want the Joyce community to take it seriously a little bit, and they, from your point of view, pick the wrong person to review it, and that's the only review you get, right? That's it?
Yes, and then the next stage was that when I went back to see if I could talk with the editors again, the book had been reprinted, and there was nothing in it about her. So
what book was reprinted?
I'm sorry, it wasn't the book. It was the James Joyce Quarterly, had been reprinted, and
they took her review out.
No, what they did, they just ignored it, and the next edition of the I'm trying to think, all these things are so far in the past.
Yes.
I saw that particular essay had been something was reprinted. And it didn't matter anymore.
I see. It didn't happen. It didn't get reprinted, is what you're saying.
Right. That's right.
Right. So I have the only copy of it. That winter 95. That issue is the only one that has the review in it. That's interesting.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
And the name is Martha Fodasky Black. She was at Brooklyn College, CUNY, in New York City at that time. In 94.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't want to, it's a, you know, fairly long review. I don't want to go through all of it, but I just want to know how you react. You, in general, you think it's unfair and it's silly. They call you nuts. It's almost like she didn't read the book. But it starts off saying, Grace Eckley is like the blind man who felt the elephant's tail and concluded that the Earth's largest mammal was a reptile. Okay. In The Steadfast Fittings Wake, a textbook, she is nothing if not steadfast in her belief. Then she goes on about it. And she's saying that you don't make convincing connections. Now, I read this book, you know, 20 years ago, and I don't remember being upset by it. I remember saying, wow, that's pretty interesting. But when I read your new version that came out, you know, last year, you got a lot of details in there. Would there be quite a difference between your 2018 book and this 94 book? Would you admit that there was a lot more proof in the new book, or is it about the same?
I was still the same person. I could see I think what happened was that she was probably jealous of all of my connections in Dublin, because I was with the Kylie and all of his buddies and that sort of thing, and I think that must have set her off.
Well, why would she, did she live in Dublin? Why would she be concerned about that?
Well, she traveled quite a bit, and I never did find out why she came to Dublin.
Oh, I see. And she found out that you knew a lot of people. So she was haunted by her own review, because whenever she went into the Joyce world, you were already there and known.
I suppose something like that happened.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let's see. It says, thus, despite Eckley's final call for new scholarship on the Stead and British connections, this book, The Steadfast Finnegan's Wake, is a blind alley, circumscribed by its refusal to see beyond Stead and his contemporaries. Now, you find a lot of more information. It's not a blind alley for you when you prepare for your second book, right? It's not a blind alley.
It opened up a whole new world, actually.
Right.
Because I was teaching at Drake, and I was teaching Joyce's Ulysses, but my scholarship was in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, so that I had a sort of split identity there as far as I was concerned, the work I was doing.
All right, so you you get this bad review, but it doesn't matter. You keep carrying on. How controversial did you become, your thesis?
I'm not sure that it became controversial. I remember that there were some peculiar publications with the Joyce industry, but they just let them go, and nobody attacked me for saying anything different that I know of.
But you didn't get any more reviews?
Oh, not of that sort, no.
Right.
Not of that sort.
So would you say that, okay, so you're saying that the thesis about Stead as a biographical original is not thrown away. People, it's standing there, and if they want to do more, okay, but they're not rejecting it as much as this reviewer did.
Would no. You,
well, that's no, pretty they, good.
Yeah, but it was, there was such a swamp of publications about Joyce's Ulysses that that's why it became called the Joyce industry, because
yes.
Everybody was turning out anything they could think of was what it amounted to, and so they didn't object to somebody saying something else about Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Okay, so the main focus is on Ulysses. So you put out Maiden Tribute. Do you know the year that came out?
Oh, I have a copy of it here on the shelf. Yeah. Let's see. That's 2007.
Okay. So that's another 12 years after the 94 book. So as you studied, looked more and more into Stead, you realized what an amazing guy he was, and then it led you to say, wow, I've got to make a biography of him. So that's what you did. You know, you just had gathered so much that you could do a biography? Is that how it unfolded?
I don't know if one sees that much farther ahead. This biography was, I started with his work in Darlington, which is northern England, and then followed through his life as far as I could go in that. And then.
Okay, but see, you're doing the textbook. You've done the textbook. So now there's more to be learned about Stead, and you know the world's forgotten him. So you felt, you know, as if that was an important thing to do a biography of him.
Yes, something like that.
Right. And of course, you discovered a lot more about his theosophical interests, his occult interests, and all the stuff, which is included in the new encryption book, right? It's sort of, it goes over the basic outline of the biography, Maiden Tribute. You put the basic stuff into the encryption book.
Yeah, but there were other things that I was doing in between. I just, I'm really careless about my own publications, and I don't keep a record of it. I became aware of that just recently. But I did other books, too. I did one on Finley Peter Dunn, for example.
Yeah.
And
Edna O'Brien.
Yes, and Edna O'Brien and all that sort of thing. So you know about those.
So you have, you're seen as a scholar of Ireland?
I don't know how anybody viewed me unless they reviewed the book.
No, but like you're doing books on Irish writers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so going to Irish conferences.
Right. So did you ever meet Robert O'Neill, McNeil? Oh, O'Driscoll. Did you ever meet Robert O'Driscoll from Toronto?
I didn't know that last name.
Yeah, Robert O'Driscoll or Robert O'Driscoll. He organized, did a couple of conferences on Celtic consciousness. Did you go to those kind of conferences?
No, not especially unless I had another reason to go. So
yeah.
I had two reasons to be there. But you see, I had children that I was rearing. I had three sons, and I had to tend to their education and their upbringing. So
yeah.
I had plenty to do at home.
But you managed to put out all these books. Okay, so let's see. James Joyce, you found some interesting material on his research into Stead. For people who don't know anything about Stead or even Joyce, the first thing that happened is that he wrote, James Joyce, when he was like 18, wrote a review on Ibsen, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Stead had his review of reviews, and he commented on the Ibsen article by the young James Joyce, correct?
Yes. Stead, by the way, was peculiar. He was the son of a minister in one of the Protestant churches. I have to stop and think a minute which church that was. And he was a hunchback. And the parents never once mentioned to him the word hunchback. And so as far as they were concerned, he was not hunchbacked. He was perfectly normal. And so there were lots of things that you could say about W.T. Stead, but what he did was take up the cause of child prostitution. And that's where he made his great name. And because he published he published his accusations of people for allowing this prostitution to continue unabated, and women were the only ones who were blamed for it, you know, and he was always a defender of women.
Yes.
He went to jail for publishing on it.
Yes. And now, did you say that Stead was the hunchback or his father was a hunchback?
Stead himself was a hunchback.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But I thought you were saying the father. Okay, so that's an amazing point because HCE is a hunchback, supposedly, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
I am, too. I am, too, by the way.
Oh, really?
I have a hunch also. And one of my correspondents wrote and said, "You mean you're a hunchback and you're writing a book about a hunchback? I call that weird."
Well, is this something you developed or had since you were young?
My situation, I think, did not show up much when I was a child. it just got worse as I got older.
Right. Okay, so in Finnegan's Wake, Humphrey Chipton Earwicker, HCE, he's always being imprisoned and then let out, and then he goes back to jail. And the neat thing is that's what Stead did. He went to jail several times, right?
No, I think only once.
Just once. But he was moved around.
Let's see.
He went to three jails in that one sentence.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Because they had to decide what to do with him because they hadn't any situation like that before. And so the movement among the jails was partly because he was tried in one jail and then sent to another. You see, that way it got to be three of them by the time he was finished.
Yes. And he was only in jail for a few months. You know, it wasn't a big interruption in his life. But is once I became aware through your books about him, I would say that women, you know, you never heard of Stead, did you? And no, I don't know who he is. Well, he's the founder of feminism. He's the guy that started it, gave you guys a break. Would you agree with that, that he's an unknown feminist hero?
What does feminist mean?
People who seem to be for women's rights and think that women
yes, definitely. He was fighting for women's rights when nobody else was.
Right, and
the sailors who came into the ports, of course, were all infected with diseases and such, and nobody defended the women, but the women were accused of being the people who spread the diseases.
Right, right. But
so that's why Stead sided with the women.
Yes, but you don't see, I don't know. I haven't read that many feminist books, but do any feminists talk about Stead? Did you ever find anybody in the Gloria Steinem world?
No, I don't think so.
Yes.
I was so busy with all those things about Stead that I didn't look whether anybody else was ignoring him. I do know that when I taught a class in summer school at Drake, I had a student in class who told me that she had been out on the campus of Kent State University when the student was killed there. And she said that the ghost of one of those students who was killed continued to haunt her at the time she was in my class. And so I kept her notes on that, and I still have them somewhere in one of my files.
Yes, you've already met. This is the professor. I thought she was a professor. She became a professor?
I think we're talking about two different people, because I didn't have any writing about that student. I had only her comment when she was in my class.
Oh, okay. But the other professor was visited. There's two people visited by ghosts, is what you're saying.
Oh, well, what happened with James Joyce was that as a child, he had been haunted by those ghosts when he was in school.
Right.
And so that's why that's so important, because he wants to know where they come from. He's certain that they're there, but they live in another world. And so that turns out to be very important to Joyce's development and everybody concerned.
Right. What did I've sent you two recordings of my talking with the ghost of James Joyce. I don't know if it really is or not, but it's a pretty good dialogue in 1995.
Excellent.
Right, and then I did another one in 2009. Yeah, 2009. But in the second one, the quote, James Joyce tells me that he went to gypsy mediums a lot, because he was in quite anxiety about what he was doing with Finnegan's Wake. He didn't know if it was the right move or not. And his wife, Nora, thought he was having affairs and didn't mind thinking that. She was horrified at the idea that someone was talking to a medium and talking to ghosts. That's what scared her, and she didn't want to think about it. That was pretty interesting, that story.
Yeah, Nora would not have anything to do with it.
Right. she just was, you know, I guess Catholic and afraid. But she didn't mind thinking that he had affairs as long as she didn't have to think about the ghost. So when you hear the ghost tell me that, the James Joyce ghost, does that sound plausible that Joyce would go to mediums, gypsies and that? Does that sound...
Oh, yeah. He had a vast curiosity. And same as the rest of us, I guess. And so he went where he pleased.
Yeah,
he would investigate a topic if he was interested in it.
Right. So, and, you know, mediumship, scholars say, occurs throughout Finnegan's Wake. At least it's based on Oscar Wilde mediumship and then the Stead mediumship. It is almost a major theme or motif in Finnegan's Wake. Would you agree?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd say it was in there, yes.
Okay, so you told me about Josh. Is that his name? Josh Bevan, the Joyce scholar? Let me look up.
Josh
who? The guy who wrecked your slides.
Oh, that one. That was at the Joyce Conference in New York City. Yes, I had gone with a carousel of slides to present information that I had uncovered, and he was drunk, and he just deliberately upset my slides so that they were all dumped on the floor, and I tried to put them back in order and continue the talk, and it was hopeless. So, yeah,
his name was Zach Bowen. Zach Bowen.
Yeah, that was Zach Bowen. He had a beautiful, operatically trained voice, and he was generally quite popular, but that, because of his voice, he sang at all kinds of Joyce meetings.
Yes.
But,
that was no fun for you. I mean, that's a disgusting thing, what he did. Was he against your thesis, or he didn't like you for other reasons?
No. He was just drunk and was trying to entertain everybody by drawing attention to himself, I think.
Jeez, pretty immature. And so he knocks over your slide tray, and he knocks them over while you're using it, while you're in the middle of your talk?
Yes, he did.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not a good memory, but have you... is there anybody else? Can you give us some gossip about the Joycean community? Who did you like?
There were early books on Joyce and the connection of, let's see what I have here on the shelf.
Did you know Hugh Kenner?
Yes, I knew Hugh Kenner. I was never a friend of his. Nothing, you know, I didn't associate with him or anything. I just knew him as one of the persons who attended the conferences.
Right. So you're looking at your book list there and seeing names.
Yes, I one of these days I'm going to try to put my titles together, but I have all kinds of publications that are not represented in any form here.
Right.
And I need to, in fact, the first time I discovered that it was, well, the first time, yes, I found out that it was possible to publish, I saw something and it was in a small periodical for educators. And I when I saw it, I said, but, you know, that's not really quite accurate. And so I wrote in a letter just responding to what I had been reading, and that man wanted to publish that immediately. So that was my first awareness that it was possible to get published. It's easy to get published.
Ah. And that's in the early 70s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... the guy you did narrator and character with, Begnell, Michael Begnell?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, did he go on to do other books? I kind of recall his name.
Yes, he did, but not in the areas that I was interested in. He did publish some other things.
Right. Okay, so who are some scholars that you respect?
I don't have anything against most of them. You've heard the worst of it, I think.
but you're not friends with them.
Well, you see, I have three children to rear.
Yeah.
I'm very busy with all of their activities, and all of them have done very well. My first son went to Harvard, and then after that didn't even tell people that he had gone to Harvard, except that there's a funny story about it. He does mention it. The funny thing. When the famous professor whose class he was in said that he was watching television and that someone presented an apple to the teacher, and he said, "Nobody has ever presented an apple to me." And so the students, with 125 students in each section, see, they just got together and they bought apples. The next day, when the class began, each student walked up one at a time and deposited an apple in front of the professor. So, you know, he had good things going on.
What's his name? Do you remember?
My son. Oh, you mean the professor?
Yeah, the professor.
Oh, let me see. Oh, I can't think. I can think of his face. I can't think of his name.
But he's famous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, anybody who was a professor at Harvard was famous.
Okay, so so I'm trying to get stories out of you about different characters. Oh, did you know Edeline Glashine?
I wrote about, I used her articles, her information and everything. Some of it was helpful, but she really didn't have much to go on, and she did a lot of good work, as we say. But I don't see that any of it is leading anywhere much.
I see. So you feel that what you found leads somewhere?
I guess it does.
Yeah, you know, I lived in New York City from 1993 to 2008, 15 years, and pretty well every day for the first 7 years. I didn't live where I'm going to say in the second 7 years, but the first 7 years I lived on East 91st, and I'd walk over to Fifth Avenue and then walk into the Reservoir, which is a very nice walking area in the middle of Central Park. And every day I would pass the little plaque of W.T. Stead on the wall of the Reservoir at East 91st Street.
Yes.
And Fifth Avenue. I suppose you've seen that a few times. You've been there, right?
I had a friend that I corresponded with. I never did meet him, but he used to send me materials about that. And so he photographed it and sent it to me. So I definitely had the plaque and that in my background, yes.
Right, but you never walked by it. You never looked at it in person.
Yes, I did one time when I was there.
Okay.
And I brushed the snow off it. I remember doing that.
Right. Now, on that street are the famous Jewish establishment, Otto Kahn and a bunch of other very wealthy people. Why did they sponsor the plaque, the rich I don't know if it was all Jewish or not, but the rich people there in that part of New York City in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, those streets, a lot of mansions. Why was he popular among rich people since he was so controversial?
Why was the statue there is the question you're asking.
Yes. What is it? I mean, it's a tribute to the fact that he died on the Titanic and he didn't make it to New York City. He was coming to New York as a guest of somebody. Maybe you have it in your biography, and he didn't make it. But they remembered him and put a plaque up. I don't know when the plaque was put up. But this is a plaque for someone that the world doesn't know about until you showed up.
Stead did a whole lot of things that got people's attention. For one thing, he published an article predicting the sinking of the Titanic.
Yes.
And he said this is what will happen if the boats continued to sail with insufficient lifeboats, you know.
Yes.
So that was very famous, and there were other things that were quite famous. But at home, when people got news that he had been drowned on the Titanic, they refused to believe it, and they just had a terrible time getting used to the idea that Stead was no more with them.
Right, and that he had predicted it.
Yes, he had predicted that the Titanic would sink in somewhat similar circumstances with insufficient lifeboats.
Well, why did he go on it?
He always obeyed some sort of inner voice, something that told him that he should do this or that. He was always very much in touch with his deity, whom he called the senior partner. Did you know about the senior partner?
Yes. Yeah, you mentioned it in your book. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, Stead was very close to his senior partner. He did what that person suggested that he should do.
Right, and he may have been a medium himself, right?
Oh, he was, definitely, yes. And also produced some works in that line.
Yes. So did that get you interested in mediumship, the whole Stead story?
Let's see. Probably it did. I'm trying to think of when I first started writing about that. Yes, I think it did.
Well, did you ever go to any mediums yourself?
Not for my own purposes, except that I knew a person who did it as sort of a sideline, and I just listened to her. I didn't really gain anything from her.
Right. You mean you went and talked to her?
Yes.
Right. So you had your mind blown. I should explain. Now, there's a Facebook forum called Reading Phineas Wake, and I just showed up there a few weeks ago, and I posted some good statements by Marsha McLuhan about Phineas Wake, and they liked that. But then somebody made a snarky remark about me or something. So I said, okay, how about this? And actually, they made a snarky remark about McLuhan. So I said, well, how about this? And just before I called you, I checked, no comments yet, but it's the first interview with Joyce, which was done through a man named Michael Blake Reed, who channeled 6,000, 7,000 entities called the Evergreens, and the Evergreens could bring someone in like James Joyce, and you could talk to Joyce. But he wasn't a member of the Evergreens, the group of entities that Michael Blake Reed channeled. But you listened to it, and you said you had your mind blown. What's the content of a blown mind? What happened to you?
When did I say that I had my mind blown by what?
By the recording I sent you. Here, let me bring up the...
Oh, yes. Because you confirmed much of what I had known, that... there is life after death and that those people can communicate. The thing is that no matter how religious people were and they thought that their loved ones went to heaven, they didn't know that they could communicate with them, and they didn't ask questions about what are those people doing. And that's what your tape accomplished with the medium.
Right, like for you, it sounded pretty real.
Oh, yes, I thought it was real.
Yes, for me it's real. It's controversial how he talks about Marsha McLuhan, but the big thing that I was impressed with, he says, first of all, it was not a dream, and then he said it was about the present. And it was almost like Phineas Wake was a diary, recording every day, and he gave an example. He said, your stomach, he says to me, the James Joyce spirit. Your stomach just growled because you're hungry.
Yeah.
And you don't notice it, but I heard it. And then I realized, yes, you're right, it did growl. And he said, that's what I was recording, things happening in the immediate present. Now, is there any Joyce scholar who would have, you know, thought of that? Can you think of anybody?
No.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Now, McLuhan did. McLuhan did, but it's a pretty abstract statement. But he said that Joyce would take the particular of the moment and the drama of cognition and the drama of sensation, and he would register it. There's a very interesting sentence by McLuhan. But anyways, the point is that it's sort of obvious when Joyce said to me, yeah, that's what he's doing. He's recording everything that's happening to him in the moment.
Yes, and that's what you would think that people would want those in the afterlife to do, to participate in our continued lives.
Yes.
And there are touches of that. I can't think of an exact example just now, but there are touches of that in Finnegan's Wake. But what happened with James Joyce was that when he was in school, he had those experiences with the ghosts of people showing up there at his school.
Right.
So that became very important in his development.
Right.
He never let that go.
Yeah, and Frank Budgen said, you know, he said, Mom, my friend James Joyce, he's psychic. He knew it.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's not the scholars, at least in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they never would point, they didn't know about it or they didn't care about it. They didn't pick up on the mediumship or psychic part because literate people tend to, you know, put that down and think it's stupid. But they missed out something that Joyce was doing. So here's what you wrote. You said, however, you're saying, I've managed to avoid flying in the last 3 or so years, and I'm pleased to continue that way. However, the tape you sent blows my mind, as the younger generation says. I hope we can continue working together on its substance and perhaps, as you suggest, work toward a possible interview, which we're now doing. But the thing was, you were delighted. You're saying you got your mind blown. You're delighted that it kind of confirmed what you had suspected.
Yes, that's right, exactly. And I looked up the price of tickets to Honolulu so that I actually found out that because it's a dependency of the United States that you can fly there for practically nothing.
That's right. And what's the reason? Did you give a reason?
It's a dependency of the United
States. Oh, okay, yes, yeah.
It's part of the United States.
Yes.
That's where Pearl Harbor took place and all those things.
Right, and, you know, it's a state, and it's the biggest, proportionally, the biggest welfare state.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Hawaiians and Filipinos and whatever on welfare here, maybe even other races. What?
Yeah. A lot of people who retire there.
Yes, but there's a lot of people who are homeless who retire here because it's a pretty comfortable environment. Anyways, it's such a great place that I was a Canadian and I became an American so I could stay here. I never wanted to be deported or have to get out. So I became an American in 2017 after being here, well, that's like 8 years or so, since 2008. Now I'm in my 11th year, and it's amazing. And you can get good flying, prices to come here at different points if you look at...
I saw that. My son Doug has already been there.
Yes.
He had a friend who retired there, and he went to visit him one time.
Yeah.
He
liked it.
About it. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So now what I'm going to reread your book again because it's fun. And my wife is reading it, and she has only read a few Joyce scholarly books, but she has been a member of our Finnegan's Wake group. But she's finding it really enjoyable. She likes the way you write and the things you point out. So that's a pretty big accomplishment to get her liking a book on Finnegan's Wake. Because She doesn't.
I made a note here to tell you something before you called. And if you look at page 338 in that book,
yeah,
there's an interesting thing which Stead would have loved because it shows. Oh, heck, I picked up the wrong book.
I'm looking at it, page 338.
Yeah, and it's that poem about the person who determines that he's going to rape the girl.
And yeah, it begins, woman in the kitchen?
Yes, woman in the kitchen. And there he comes in as one of the privileged people, you know,
yeah,
and doesn't know how to behave. So he's a member of the elite. And then he says he wants food. And if she doesn't give it to him, he's going to, I forgot how he phrased
I'll
it.
I'll shove you in a corner. And when you've lost your honor, I'll tell the old professor.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah, he's basically, I'll rape you if you don't give me any food.
Yeah.
So where is this from? A poem in Keller's Translation. Like, when was this written, this poem?
Kelleher was one of those persons, the one who collected that poem, was one of those persons who has a vast background and everybody knows that he knows everything, but he never gets it put into print. And so that's from one of his collections, and so everybody respected him for his knowledge, but he didn't publish much.
And right, so but he wrote poems, but they didn't get published.
No, he didn't write poems. He studied things.
Oh, okay. So he was a good talker.
Yes.
Good talker. Okay, right. So now I want to go take another angle here. Let's see, what was I going to say? How do you relate the Stead story to the Jungian? Do you write on the Jungian archetypes or motifs in other books? Because you don't do much here. You bring it up.
You have to know a little bit about it, you know. But that book called The Maiden Tribute is about the only one where I comment on that.
Oh, okay. So you go into details. So
Maiden Tribute, The Life of W.T. Stead, yeah.
Right. Now, did that do well? Many people buy a copy?
Yeah, it was okay. I wasn't publishing it for profit. I just published it because that's what I was interested in.
Did it get any major reviews?
I don't think so. There was a publisher that I didn't trust, and so I didn't do anything about that. I mean, a publishing house.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to list it with them, and I distrusted them, and I thought they were just interested in taking advantage of people. And they said that they would have it listed in a conference in California, and that they were going to have it advertised in the New York Times and that sort of thing. And I just broke off with them because I didn't trust them at all. So I didn't intend to make money from it, and I don't think I did.
Right, but so did they publish it?
No, I published it myself.
Oh, okay. So what do you think it is about Stead? How come he can't become known? Because he was I can see why Joyce would be amazed by him, fascinated by him, because okay, sometimes I think Joyce, he acted out different media. So he was a newspaper editor. He ran a newspaper, and people would send information to him, or Samuel Beckett and them would look up stuff. So he would gather the information and throw it into the book as if he was making a newspaper. Now, so he was an information junkie, maybe, Joyce was, but Stead was the original information junkie.
That's right, he was. It was as if, that's an excellent way of putting it. It was as if Stead had to know everything.
And Joyce was like that. Like, you can see why Joyce would be impressed with him. And it's in the telegraph era. He shows up right when people can get information from all over the world. And was there anybody else who did what Stead did? I don't think so. The Review of Reviews was a unique paper, right?
Yes, it was. It was entirely new. And it was because he wanted to publish the information. So
yes.
He was, you have a good phrase for it, a junkie.
Information junkie. Yeah, and he did the Reader's Digest before there was a Reader's Digest.
Yes, that's right.
Review of Reviews.
I'm just looking at one of my titles here across from me. It's by Begnell and Sen, and it's called A Comprehensive Guide to Finnegan's Wake. That was published by Penn State. I haven't kept a list of my publications, and I should try to give some time to that and see if I can round them up. Maybe.
Well, so that's the guy who did the book with you, narrator and character, and he did a book with Fritz Sen. Why did you just mention it?
It's on the shelf here in front of me.
So you mean it's you're just pointing it out that you have some books on Finnegan's Wake?
Yes.
But the thing is, he was an extraordinary. You know, I haven't read the Maiden Tribute. I have it here, but I haven't read it yet. But there's a lot of major details about his phenomenon in the encryption book. I mean, this guy, he was Bertrand Russell or Abby Hoffman or anybody that went around and made a big name for himself and was in the middle of the information world of the last 150 years. He was a major version of that. You know, he was like a Steve Allen or Jack Parr or something.
It's absolutely astonishing how much Stead turned out. And I have in Colorado, where our son bought our house in Colorado, so he has quite a few of my things still left in that house.
Yes.
And he has just all sorts of things so that this Begnell and Sen, a conceptual guide to Finnegan's Wake, is among the stuff there. I imagine it's in some sort of bibliography, but I just don't, as I said, I don't keep track of my own publications, and I need to start doing that.
Yes. Now, so Stead, he would go to these conferences, he would dominate them, he had all this energy, you know what I mean? He was like a Dick Gregory. I don't know if you remember Dick Gregory?
No, I didn't know Dick Gregory, but you know what? Stead had a continual battle with Swinburne, and so the two of them would set each other up.
Yeah.
And Swinburne was totally opposed to W.T. Stead, and if he was going out of town, he had to have the newspaper saved for him because he had to read what W.T. Stead said. And then he would publish something opposing it.
Right.
It's a piece, right.
Well, what was it about Stead? He was not liked. He was pretty intense. He outdid everybody on the energy level. Nobody wrote as much as he did. Nobody knew as much. He was an activist on every issue, it seemed. And I'm just...
Well, part of it was the fact that he was a hunchback. And his parents always ignored that and put him into everything, and he was into everything. and the children on the playground might make fun of him, but he just went on his own way, you know, and he just made the intelligence part of living the big factor in his life.
Right, so he wasn't bothered by ridicule. He had it all his life, so it didn't mean anything to him.
That's right, yes. And he knew that the children were making fun of him, but he just ignored it.
Right. So he had a thick skin. And it would have been, if he hadn't have died on the Titanic, I think he would have really made an amazing impact. It would have accumulated into the 20s and 30s, you know, 1920s, 1930s. he would have been he would have become known if he just stayed the course and hadn't died.
Yeah.
He really would have become a phenomenon. And he was, he really was well known. He's one of the most well known people around in the 1880s and 90s and before he died. And he had wealthy people courting him. He had,
he had published so much, you'd be astonished if you saw a list of his publications, like children's books and all sorts of things.
Yes, I can tell from your book that he did that. So to me, it's obvious that Joyce would be impressed with this guy. He's almost like a role model for Joyce.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't see why people wouldn't see that. You know, if who do young people like today? They might like some bicyclist or somebody who died protesting something.
Their idea of anything these days is Facebook, and I'm not a part of it. I never latched onto Facebook. I don't do anything with it. But that's what the young people consider research now.
Yes, no, I know. It's a whole different situation. But they have their heroes, but I don't know. I mean, there's so many different media and so many different heroes, but you can see that Stead was a major hero of his day. I mean, this guy, he's as important as George Bernard Shaw in a way. Or would he be considered a Fabian socialist?
Oh, I don't think so.
He wasn't a socialist. He was more like a moralist or something, right? A Christian.
That's right. Yes, a moralist is a good word for what he was.
Yeah. But it seems he really lived up to his standards. I mean, he did his best to be a Christian. And he's the archetypal liberal humanist Christian.
Wherever he saw that something needed to be published, he published it, like considering that children had nothing to read. And so he brings out a whole collection of children's books, you know.
Right.
That sort of thing. So,
that's pretty amazing. You know, back, you know, growing up in the 20th century, people had an idea, well, at least the white people I knew, they had an idea of a Christian lifestyle. You know, you do a few good things, you contribute here and there, you don't lie. That's sort of like the bourgeois model of being a good Christian. This guy was the original model for all that. He was the original nice Christian in an information society.
That's right.
Yeah, he's an archetype, the guy himself.
I have in my house in Colorado a lot of those books that he produced for the children's subscribers to his philosophy. It's just amazing what he turned out.
So you've collected, you have an archive of his output.
Well, when I started, well, if you're a researcher, what you do is learn everything you can.
Yeah.
And so when I started researching W.T. Stead, then I started collecting W.T. Stead's contributions to society. So I bought whatever I could find that was available, and I even listed that I was looking for some of them. So.
Right. So is there a W.T. Stead fan society?
A W.T. Stead what society?
A fan. You know, people who are fans of W.T. Stead.
Oh, no. And not even on Hailing Island, which was where he had a home.
Yes.
A summer home. They don't even do much with it there. Because I sent them something, you know, to tell them that something was available. And they didn't even bother to reply to it.
Wow.
It's as if I don't know whether they get tired of someone being as famous as that or whether they just have to do things for themselves and they're not interested in anything else.
Right. Well, I think a big factor is he hit on the core scandal of British society. I mean, you read his research and your books, there's this image in the West that Britain was a civilized place in the 19th century. It was a moral standard, you know, the typical maybe white bias. But it had this incredible image, and he punctured the heart of its hypocrisy, which was outrageous.
But that is an excellent statement that you have just made. That is wonderful.
I hope we got that on tape. That's right. I mean, so it's almost like he hit the heart of the hypocrisy of Christian civilization so accurately that he makes people uncomfortable, even though it's ridiculous.
Yes.
Nobody should be uncomfortable about child prostitution. It should just be stopped. You know, you just don't do it. And but it embarrasses people. Maybe he picked on. He's sort of like a Larry Flint in reverse. He exposes the pornography of the society. And
even when he went to jail for having published his research on prostitution, and child sites, and all that, even in jail, he was still carrying on that way and corresponding with someone who wrote to him while he was in jail and that sort of thing. He never stopped.
Yeah, that's right. He was the ultimate activist.
Yes, he was.
You know, like a Malcolm Muggeridge or, you know, Bertrand Russell was famous, and there's probably famous guys on the left and there's famous guys on the right, like maybe William Buckley on the right. Who would be on the left? I.F. Stone, remember him? He was a big activist and put out a lot of information. You ever heard of him, I.F. Stone?
No, I don't know that name.
All right. Well, and there's a few others, but, you know, before Stead, you had Edison and Steele, is it? The Spectator.
Yeah.
And you'd have Thomas Carlyle or Malcolm Arnold or Matthew Arnold, novelists, Dickens, but nobody did daily newspaper topics like Stead did. He was the first.
That's right. He was.
You know, McLuhan has this interesting point in his book, Understanding Media. He says, the image for the Telegraph was Florence Nightingale. The image, the icon for movies was Charlie Chaplin. The icon for radio was Hitler. He then, you know, in the 60s, who was the icon for television? Well, it was still new and nobody, you know, who would be? It could be, Ed Sullivan, Walter Cronkite, you know, maybe someone like that. But the icon of newspaper activism and newspaper telegraph, even though Florence Nightingale got the image of nursing and all that, but Stead is the missing guy. He's the icon at the end of the 19th century of the beginning of the electric age. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, he was. Yes, definitely. He even sent the review of reviews when he started editing it to New Zealand, places like that, you know.
Yeah, all over the world.
Yep, that's right.
He put on the whole, matter of fact, Carolyn was giving me, my wife was giving me a quote two nights ago that somebody said, you know, the whole goal is to be an editor. It's the ultimate power. And he read that quote and said, I want to be an editor. Do you remember that?
No.
Yeah, it's Thomas Carlyle or somebody said, Stead, he's a great guy. Keep editing. Keep up the good work. It's some quote you have in your book.
I remember. Yeah, he did quote Carlyle.
Yes, yeah. and he was the editor, and he said,
yeah.
"Boy, you got a pulpit. You got 50,000 people listen to you every day."
That's right. Yeah.
So I'm bringing my McLuhan angle to it, and that he's an information junkie. He's what people are today, but he was unique. He was the first, and had the ability to do it. And, be ridiculously productive and cover every, right. I mean, how does a guy write so much? All day long, every day, you know?
That's right. He would even get up in the night and continue writing.
Right. Now, was he typing or writing?
No, he didn't. He was writing.
Yeah, no, the typewriters hadn't come in yet, I guess.
Well, he was advertising them as soon as they came in, but he did not learn to type himself, but he had secretaries and such who used the typewriter.
Oh, okay. So what was his relationship with his wife like? Were they no scandals, a proper marriage?
His wife didn't understand him, really, as I think of it. They had a beautiful big house, and she liked to show off the house, of course, but she didn't do anything with his part in it. He had, as far as I know, she kept things going as a wife should, but Stead was mostly on his own in regard to what he was writing about.
Right. She was not a fellow activist.
No.
So that would be like Nora Barnacle. That'd be like Nora and Joyce.
Yeah, somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, she was, you know, there is a book on her, and she might have been more interested in all the stuff and understood it more than people had presented her. But she's not creating. She's not a, you know, a Joan Baez or somebody making media. Like you could take Jane Fonda and Ted Turner, or the politician that Jane Fonda was married to, Tom Hayden. She could have been that kind of person, but she wasn't. Was she literate? Could she read?
Oh yes, yes, she could do that. She did quite a few things. She was this is Stead's wife you're talking about. Right.
Yes.
They had a big house where the tennis courts are now, and Stead got the idea that they should share those with everybody, of course. And so he advertised that anybody who was riding a bicycle, because he became a fan of bicycle riding, anyone
right.
who was riding a bicycle through the territory could stay overnight at his house.
Wow.
He put up a big tent for them so that they would be comfortable there. It was just wherever something needed to be done, he thought of a way of doing it. He
yeah.
was just incredible.
Yeah, he was the nicest guy on the planet.
That's right. And people didn't even know it.
That's right. They didn't know it. He was so active, he created information overload that nobody could keep up with him. And it was like a blizzard of snow he was putting out on everybody, and he got lost in the snow. Nobody could see who was putting the blizzard out.
If you ever want to see something funny, though, get his opposition with Swinburne, because Swinburne just hated his guts, and if he went out of town, he had to make sure that he got Stead's publication saved for him so that he could oppose him when he
So what is it? That's what's interesting. Who actually liked Stead, who was famous? Was there anybody? I mean, Rhodes did for a while, but everybody got in trouble around Stead.
That's funny. I never heard of that before. That's because if anyone got in trouble around him, it was because he would just confront them.
He'd be honest.
He didn't know. Yeah, he didn't know that it was trouble. It was just activity as far as he was concerned. And if anybody had asked him, he would have said he was doing the Lord's work.
Right. Yeah, he actually was a Christ-like figure. The more you get into what he did, he'd go to conferences and just wow everybody. He didn't sleep. He just, you know, interacted with everybody. He was a nice,
yes.
humble guy. He had a message, but he seemed to be really friendly. I mean, he was a modern version of Christ.
You're right that he didn't sleep very much, because when other people were still sleeping, he'd get up and start working in the night.
Right. The guy had incredible energy, like he was divinely possessed or something.
Right, that's right.
He even predicted, well, that's incredible. People laugh when they hear this. He says, yeah, the Titanic's going to sink, and I'm going on it.
That's exactly it.
He went on there to help people, probably. He said, everybody's going to die. I'm also going on there to help them. I'm not going to die, but I'll save everybody. And does anybody know how he died? Does he get on a boat and just starve, or there's no record?
They say that he knew that the Titanic was sinking. He knew that that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And he talked with people, and he listened to what the reports were. They had a short wave, you know, so that they could get reports on what was happening to themselves. And he knew that. He knew all of that. But as far as he was concerned, that was part of his destiny. That was his senior partner. His deity was always his senior partner.
And he knew he'd survive death also, right?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I say if I died on my gravestone, I'd have the words, "I'll be right back." Well, Stead was like that. He came right back.
Yes, that was, yes.
You know, I had a friend who in New York City, and he knew he was going to die, and he said, "I'm going to talk to you, Bob. I'm going to get to you to prove that I survived death." And he actually died and came through a medium. A year later, he proved to me he survived death.
Yes.
You know, and so I've got that proof with him. But I didn't know what happened, but it's not public proof. If I tape recorded it and registered it all, you know, and beforehand, then it would be something you could say. But I didn't do anything about it. After he came back, I've got years of talking to him through a medium.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty rare, eh? Not many people. Yeah, Aldous Huxley's wife, Laura, tried that. She said, "Okay, you're going to give me a message." She writes about this in her biography. And so he dies on the day Kennedy was assassinated, November 22nd, 63, while taking LSD. Aldous Huxley died. And he, within a year or two, he left the message. He communicated to Laura. He completed the deal. But mm-hmm. not many people can say they set that up.
The best statement in my book, on that one called Maiden Tribute, A Life of Stead, is on the first page, where it says the world's work was to be done by himself, with the assistance and the direction of a senior partner. Such was his interpretation of the duties enjoined upon him by his father's Congregational Church.
Wow.
A little democracy in which women voted equally with men, which called its own minister, managed its own affairs, impressed on all its members their responsibility for others, and owed allegiance to no one but Jesus Christ.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm going to go read that. In my own copy. So that's a good point to end on. Maybe we can do, after a break, we could do another in a few weeks or months, or maybe there's more stuff after I read it.
Since my memory is so bad and I have to look for things to remind me what I should say, if you would tell me in advance, perhaps by email or something, what topics you might bring up, then I might be better prepared.
No, you've done well, but that's right. We can make it better. The 'cause it's right now, it's 4:30 in the morning, and I've got to get up early, so I better get some sleep. So it's been wonderful talking to you, Grace. Really great to have met you, and maybe we'll meet sometime in person, but definitely I'll see when I reread your book what ideas I come up with or what other. Is there anybody else doing research with you, building the case, or are you just doing it by yourself?
I haven't done much since my husband died. That was 2 years ago. I haven't socialized much or anything. So,
you know, I have a radio show. And, well, did anybody help you, you know, when you're a professor?
I'm sure there was somebody, but I'd have to think about it.
Right. But mainly you've been doing it by yourself. Okay,
right.
So, you know, in the second dialogue with Joyce, it came through this person that we call Ion. So I engage Ion twice a week, 2 hours on Tuesday, 12 hours on every Saturday. We talk to Ion which is non-physical, for 12 hours. I'd like to invite you on the show, and you can talk to W.T. Stead and Joyce and your husband and anybody you want to talk to. So think about it.
Yes, I shall.
Yes, so, and I can talk to Stead too. I'll do it even if you don't show up.
That would be great.
All right, so let's end on that point. And this is Bob Dobbs talking to Grace Eckley, last seen being a professor at Drake University, 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
Oh, no, we went farther than that. We were in Bilkent in Ankara, Turkey, for example, and that's why you find mentions of Turkey in my staff, my publications. And
you went and taught, your last place was in Turkey?
Yes.
And when was that? How many years ago?
That was just a few years ago. That was at Bilkent University, which is outside Ankara, and Ankara is the capital city.
Yeah, right, right.
We did a great deal with bringing in professors from everywhere and made it such a place that English was the language that the students had to pass in order to get admitted to the school, and so a lot of things happened there.
Right, so what did you teach Stead and Joyce? Is that what you taught?
Oh, no, what I taught was a curriculum that they imposed on us, and it was not a good curriculum.
I see.
They didn't know how to make a good curriculum by American standards. All they had to do was get the students as efficient in English, and that was their primary concern.
So why did you do this? You just wanted to travel?
Yeah, there was a publication that tells where jobs are available, you know, and
yeah.
And Bill and I wanted to get away from the situation at Colorado School of Mines. We wanted a break from it,
right?
Because there was some contention among some of the factors, such as who was important and who wasn't, and that sort of thing.
Right.
And so we answered an ad to teach at Bilkent, and that's where we went.
Okay. All right, so that's pretty recent. So you taught in your 80s.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's end the dialogue for now, and thanks a lot for talking to me, and I'll be broadcasting the interview. Let's hope it got recorded. I will check. Here's what I do. I go star 9. Let's see what happens.